Welcome to the Autonicast. I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm joined by my co-host, Alex Roy. Alex, how are you doing?
Hello, Edward.
We've got an interesting topic and a very special guest today. The big news this week is in the world of automobiles is that Ford is discontinuing its sedans and traditional cars in the U.S. market to concentrate on crossovers and trucks. It's a little bit outside what we typically talk about here on the Autonicast, but it's a really important issue for understanding the broader auto industry, which I think everyone in this space should have a good handle on. And we've got a very, like I said, very special guest, the man who is probably most responsible for getting me into writing about automobiles, the man who taught me how internal combustion worked over a kitchen table with a pen and pad. My own father, Mr. Paul Niedermeyer. Dad, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Ted. And hi, Alex.
How are you, Paul? I got to say, normally I would object to such, reverse nepotism. However, you and I have had some really fascinating conversations, and it makes perfect sense that Edward would be your son. And so I'm really glad to have you here because you have really extraordinary and exceptional insight to today's topic.
Well, I'm proud of it, and I think you guys have doing a great job on the Autonicast. I enjoy listening to it, and I've learned a lot from you, both of you, a tremendous amount. I mean, I really like to keep up with the autonomy issue. I'm not able to completely delve into it in great depth, but it's a really critical part of what's happening in the whole automotive scene, and you guys are my primary source of information and keeping up to date on it, so thank you.
I hope not. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and expertise as it pertains to automotive?
Like so many guys, I was just completely obsessed with cars all my life, but I never, and my dream, of course, had been to be a writer for Car and Driver or Road and Track or whatever, but obviously things didn't turn out that way for a number of reasons. And I was just a car enthusiast who, almost exactly 10 years ago, found the blog The Truth About Cars, and they were taking submissions, and I submitted an article or two, and it was accepted. And that's how it goes for a lot of people. And this is the wonderful thing about the internet and blogging and all these other opportunities for people to get involved in a field that they've never were able to pursue initially professionally.
I think you're greatly understating your insight into today's topic.
So we should mention, Paul runs a website now called curbsideclassic.com where they discuss the history of cars. And what I really love about my dad, has been a great resource for me as a car writer, is his deep sort of historical knowledge about the auto industry and especially the American market and everything. And so I just think he's the perfect guy to talk about this this fairly consequential change. I mean, let's start off with that. Would you agree that what Ford is doing here is a consequential sort of turning point in the auto industry?
It is. It's sort of the second bang of what FCA started a couple of years ago by killing their sedans. With FCA, it shocked people. I thought it was logical, and it turned out to be quite a smart move. But clearly, FCA was always, of course, more challenged with the range of their smaller cars and had been hobbled in that field much more obviously. And whereas Ford, personally, I used to see Ford when about the time Alan Mulally came back on his Ford, I actually bought into the idea of the one Ford, and that Ford was really the best positioned of the American big three to become something of a global Toyota. And I thought the whole idea of focusing on the single brand of Ford primarily and then ditching Mercury and whatever, it all to me was optimistic. And there seemed to be some hope for that. But clearly things haven't turned out that way.
Yeah. So one of the things that I tweeted was a piece of yours about all this. I just immediately thought about it. And it seems like an interesting place to start with, because it kind of gets to, I think, the root of why Detroit is getting out of cars. And it kind of illustrates this sort of what a long-term game the auto industry is, which I think is also something that new people coming into the industry now don't necessarily understand. So you wrote this piece called Name and Form that I thought really encapsulated. It was a while ago now. It's probably almost 10 years ago that you wrote it. That really encapsulated sort of one of the fundamental issues that Detroit has had with sedans. Could you like sort of summarize what that piece was about and sort of maybe how it applies to the current situation?
Yes. I mean, this is things have improved since then, but at that time was kind of a low point for the big three. And especially like in GM, I really focused on that. The whole gist of the article was the fact that GM had used, and it's hard to pin it down, but the commenters and I, we identified somewhere between 50, 60 different names that GM had used for small, compact, subcompact, and smaller medium-sized cars over its history. 50 or 60 or perhaps more names.
Yeah, I think you mentioned as many as 80.
Yeah, maybe it was 80. I can't remember. It was crazy. People kept adding more and more and more. Yeah. And the gist of the article was simply that, hey, in terms of Honda, they came into the market with the Civic and they added the Accord 3 years later or so. And, you know, they are still at or near the top and have been at or near the top of the market ever since. And that it's completely top of mind. I mean, you know, when I summed it up with, you know, if someone calls you or asks you and say, hey, you're a car expert, what do you recommend for a car? Honda has made it so easy because since the mid-70s, one could always safely have said, yeah, well, check out a Civic or a Accord. I mean, they've built on that brand name and brand equity. And I tend to think increasingly that names have become brands, and essentially to a large extent, and we're seeing that fragmentation in all the markets. This is a key core strength of Honda. And of course, a similar applies to Toyota, who's actually longer. The Corolla nameplate even goes before the Honda Civic, but I use those two particular as examples.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what's really interesting is, you know, recently Mitsubishi announced that they're going to bring back the Lancer brand, but it's not going to be, you know, a small sedan. It's going to be a crossover. So, you know, we see this, you know, this shift of what people interpret or, you know, remember a brand to mean towards what people are actually buying.
I mean, look at the same problem with Ford had when Alan Mulally brought back Taurus. The original concept of the Taurus had been damaged, and there has to be a genuine consistency, and it has to really stand for something precisely. Otherwise, you just it's just marketing, you know, BS largely.
You know, I think folks who are either in the auto industry or cover it very closely, people spend a lot of time sort of studying the, you know, relative strengths and weaknesses of each new sort of model that comes out and sort of the competitive landscape. And it's this topic that you can kind of dive into endlessly. But I think for most people, it's impossible to keep track of all of the new models and the drivetrains and all of the complexity that's in this market. It's impossible to be a truly informed consumer of cars, I think, in a lot of ways, and which is why I think the brand aspect that you're talking about and that consistency is so important. I think what's really interesting, too, is that it felt like Ford was kind of getting there with its cars. You know, the Fiesta, the Focus, the Fusion, they all had the F names. They all had similar styling. There were several generations where they were sort of really building this sort of established brand around just their car offerings. And even they kind of related that similar styling to some of their other crossovers and stuff. And it's kind of interesting that they kind of had eventually found their way to that really important model for success. But then, you know, it was kind of too little too late, right? Which is maybe sort of the big issue here generally with cars, right?
I would say so, yes. I mean, really what we're seeing now with the big three is that it's just the chickens are all coming home to roost from the problems, from their inability. It all started with the Vega and the Pinto back in 71, their first big major attempt to build subcompact cars. And well, the Pinto, you know, was a little more successful than the Vega, but in both cases, they were not really the heart of what ended up being the market of the appropriate type of car that people were looking for long term for a small compact car. And the big three have suffered ever since. And Ford had a revival in the 80s where I really thought they were getting it and where they seemed to be. But that was largely destroyed in the 90s when Jacques Nasser pursued a truck SUV strategy, and he decontented and starved the smaller, medium, smaller cars of development money. And at that point, they've never recuperated properly.
I'm curious to get your guys' opinion. So there's a guy named Jesse Halfon on Twitter. You follow him, Edward? I think you do.
Yeah, I do. Yep.
So I don't know, Paul, if you're familiar with this guy.
No.
So this guy's an attorney specializing in auto litigation and mobility issues. And he threw up a tweet yesterday where he basically says that the Ford news suggests that they see three markets, the under 25s and singles, middle-aged workers and families, and older people, empty nesters. And that the first group, under 25s, and the retirees basically, can basically replace their small cars or basically their sedans with subscription models or TNCs, especially once prices come down for those services. And they are coming down. But that group number two, middle-aged workers and families, that these are SUV customers and truck customers, and there's no way to disrupt that. So thinking about, you know, that observation, Ford is looking at the U.S. market, and I think we'd all agree that the United States is generally the R&D lab of, you know, big ideas. They're basically betting that TNCs and eventually self-driving vehicles in some capacity and maybe in some form of you know, mobility as the mobility concept evolves, are not going to be buying those vehicles. And therefore, it's pointless to compete in the segment because it's a fully commoditized segment.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I mean, I mean, these are obviously all about looking crystal balling things, but a small entry level market is vulnerable to alternatives. Always has been to used cars. I mean, this has always been the problem about the United States. That's why no one really tries to ever make or sell a really, really cheap new car. You know, I mean, Yugo tried that, whatever, but that's we'll never see cars like in India, like the Kwid here, whatever, because there's so many alternatives, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, this is one of the it kind of goes back to the very earliest days of the industry, right? Where like this conundrum of, you know, it really is not that much cheaper, at least in terms of the variable cost, to build a small car than it is to build a big car or a truck or SUV. But those bigger vehicles will always bring in more revenue. So, I mean, to some extent, this is something, especially in a market like the US where we value larger vehicles and we have the geography that supports larger vehicles and bigger roads and things like that. You know, small cars have always been marginal and in a lot of cases, like lost leaders from the get-go, right?
It's absolutely true. I mean, GM had a huge project to build a compact car right after World War II, the Cadet, and it came very close to production. It was very innovative and advanced, but they killed it at the last minute. Back then, GM's internal mandate for a product had to have a 30% gross margin. The stock market globally is pushing all car companies towards higher profit margins because 5, 10, 15 years ago, a lot of the big companies were getting by with 2, 3, 4% profit margins. But if you go back before World War II, GM consistently, I mean, during the Sloan days, 30% profit margin was the realistic expectation back then. I mean, it didn't always happen, but that's what they were operating. Anyway, they killed the Cadet because there's no way they could make that kind of profit margin on it at the time. And they've been reluctant ever since. And really, in the United States, the small car market with the big three, they only really adopted it in the early 80s because in the early 80s was that huge spike from the second energy crisis. And it scared people because the projections were that those price increases were going to keep going up towards $5 in nominal terms, meaning like $8, $9, $10 in today's dollars. And, you know, you saw Chrysler ditching almost everything except their front-wheel drive cars, and they almost ditched their pickups at the time totally. And GM and Ford were, you know, both really scrambling. And this is also a time when buyers were really buying small cars. This was the glory days of the United States, when the United States looked most like kind of like Europe, relatively speaking. But outside of that, whenever gas falls back closer to its long-term mean, and that long-term historical mean going back to the 19-teens is about $2.70 a gallon, which is very close to what we are now. And whenever gas falls back to that or better or around that, you know, big cars and big trucks inevitably dominate.
So what you're saying is in a lot of ways that market's strength over the last 30 years, let's call it, has been a little bit almost of a in the sweep of history, right? Over the century, it's a little bit of an outlier, and that to some extent what we're seeing now with the rise of crossover, particularly car-based crossovers, is in some senses like a reversion to the mean of where the U.S. market traditionally has its center of gravity. Isn't that right?
Yeah, except that that's a smaller part of the market. I mean, I sort of tongue-in-cheek left a comment because we discussed this at our website, Curbside Classic. And I said, you know, well, the big three are back to where they were in 1959, building big, large vehicles and nothing else. But obviously, back then they had, you know, 90% of the market. And today they have whatever, 30 to combined, maybe, what is it, 35, 40% or something like that. So,
yeah. You know, guys, I can't stop thinking about this through the lens of 3 to 5 or 7 years out from now, because GM, you know, Cruise, they've got these Bolts out there and they've already announced they've got a production line ready to build level 4 and 5 autonomous ready vehicles. And they're just missing the software. This seems to me like Ford's decision that it was made also through the lens of what's going to happen if and when autonomy arrives in the next, you know, 5 to 7 years. And through that lens, it would appear that they think that the Cruise automation GM plan for level 4 is a mistake. And I would tend to agree. And I'll base it on this. If you are going to deploy vehicles that are autonomous, potentially shared in a major city, you want those vehicles to be able to accommodate any type of customer. And that includes elderly people who have a harder time getting in and out of vehicles and people who may need to move things. And so the notion of putting 2 to 4 people in a shared autonomous Chevy Bolt. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but it does make a lot of sense to imagine that level 4 or 5 for a TNC in an urban area would want a crossover or SUV. And therefore, they're betting on that. And they're bifurcating the Ford brand between a performance model, the Mustang, and then everything else, which could be a shared and autonomous vehicle. And then they think that GM's whole strategy just makes no sense.
It
basically, it sounds like what Alex is saying is, to some extent, and I think he's right to some extent about this, that what we're seeing is sort of the market evolving towards what vehicles will look like, which are basically going to be sort of large interior space blobs, you know, which is what a crossover basically is. I think the other factor that maybe Alex isn't considering in this is, I think this is why Ford has to maximize their profits now, is that they have huge, huge investments. So I think it is absolutely tied to this upcoming transition, but it's because they have to, you know, make as much money as they can now, because in what is a normally, you know, capital intensive business, there are now all of these additional capital expenses that they're going to have on top of keeping their business, their core business alive, moving into this new business, which will require a lot of new technology, a lot of investments, a lot of infrastructure, that kind of stuff.
That's absolutely right on. And the low margins of the passenger car business and the low profits are just too frustrating for them.
Yeah.
They don't have the retail demand. They haven't for a long time. It's been weak.
And I think there's an interesting dynamic here too. And I'm curious, you know, because we have, along with autonomy, we have this sort of flowering of all kinds of new ideas about mobility, you know, enabled by smartphones and other kinds of new technology. Whether it's the, you know, the scooters and the e-bikes and the micromobility stuff, shuttles that maybe will have, you know, no fixed routes, all kinds of new ideas about shared mobility and micromobility and all these sorts of things. The car, the traditional car in America, was sort of the jack of all trades. It was designed to sort of do everything mobility-wise, take you to the city, get you up to the mountain, all those other things. And it's kind of becoming the master of none to some extent in a market that suddenly has many more specialized mobility options. Does that make sense?
It does to me. Yeah, and I think that, you know, we'll probably eventually see realistically people having a truck or something like that, and covering their second needs with a second car with the various different options. I, you know, rather than going all the way completely, I think more likely we'll see the reduction from either the 3 or 2 car household and dropping one of those along the way.
It's also interesting in light of, you know, other brands are increasing the number of vehicles they have in their lineups in a big way. You look at BMW and Mercedes-Benz, like they were traditionally like enthusiast brands and luxury brands that are now trying to be all things to all people. And here you've got a brand that was at one time all things to all people, but is removing, I mean, I don't want to say weaker products, but the weaker looking products. Like the Ford brand looks more alpha for removing the smaller cars, to say that you just make crossover and trucks and a sports car is a very big brand statement, because there's nothing more brand diluting to walk into a showroom and see an S class and then see an A class or B class on the same showroom floor.
Well, this is a really important point. And I talked about this too, and I feel strongly about this, that I think that, you know, branding is increasingly becoming focused more on individual cars and vehicles. And I mean, I see this very much here in the West Coast. I mean, it's stereotype here, but I see, you know, a lot of driveways with a Ford truck, you know, F-Series in a Asian brand car or a CUV next to it, whatever. Meaning that in the West Coast, big three passenger cars have been weak for decades and decades. I mean, retail-wise, extremely weak, and very few people buy them. But people buy Ford trucks. And it's a bifurcation of the brand. The brand doesn't stand for all of these things anymore. People, you know, if they got a truck, they get a Ram or a Ford. And we've seen the Toyota Tundra. This is Toyota country, but the Tundra has never, you know, barely can be sell 100,000 per year. And it hasn't been able to translate that. So branding is fragmenting to individual vehicles. Mustang, F100, this and that, whatever. And we see this in Europe. Talk about branding. I mean, with Ford and Opel, and I actually believe that the odds are very high that Ford will do a Frexit, will leave Europe at some point too.
Huh. Well, that, let's talk about that.
The European market, in a nutshell, has fragmented, split, bifurcated into two major areas. The cheap, low-end, which Renault with Dacia made a huge, huge, huge impact and is madly successful and madly profitable. And other low-end cars like, you know, Kia and a few other brands and whatever, and for VW with Skoda, oh, that's kind of gone up a bit. And then the upper end, which is, you know, the German premium brand. in the middle, Opel and Ford and Peugeot and Renault have struggled. Some have done better than others, but Opel and Ford have really been hit by this. It's all about branding. It's like clothing and fashion. They want a fashionable brand. And I tend to disagree with you about the Mercedes. You know, if some young girl gets a job and she wants a car and she wants a, you know, a nice accessory purse and whatever, she get in a car, she'll go buy an A-class car. And it's just aspirational and it's affordable. The world is really adopting fashion and branding much more stronger than ever before. And the middle of the market is being hollowed out. And what's happened in Europe is clearly happening here the same thing. And this is why Ford and Chevrolet and passenger cars are weak. They do not have a brand associated with them that's attractive and strong. But I do think, still and for the foreseeable future, that a Ford truck has a very strong brand, as does a Mustang.
One of the big conversations that's come up around this is sort of the question of whether or not this decision by Ford, and as you point out, Fiat Chrysler, it's an important point that Ford's not the first. But basically, so that's two out of the erstwhile big three. A lot of people think the GM may go down this road too, or some version of it. So is Detroit setting itself up for another 2008? That's been one of the questions that this has inspired. And you've seen a lot more. This is a cyclical business. You've seen a lot more of the ups and downs than I have. I'm really curious to hear your thoughts about, is Ford setting itself and Fiat Chrysler setting themselves up for another 2008 or some other cyclical downturn scenario where they get stuck with trucks and SUVs?
Well, I don't think it'll be something like 2008, primarily because the vehicles that they still do offer, the CUVs are much more, and the trucks are much more efficient than they were even 10 years ago. I mean, what's the best-selling non-big truck out there now? The Toyota RAV4, the standard version averages 26, 25 miles per gallon, the hybrid 32. You know, you're lucky to get that in a sedan 10, 15 years ago. So that mitigates that issue unless gas goes absolutely completely bonkers, which is not likely, although it's heading up somewhat. And trucks are getting much better mileage too. I mean, we see this now. Pickup trucks are approaching genuine 20 miles per gallon in real use. And of course, EPA highway mileage now, there are 30 miles per gallon models with the Ford and the Ram EcoDiesel versions, which, you know, are kind of on the fringes still, and Ford is going to come out with a hybrid undoubtedly. So no, I don't think so. Although there is absolutely no doubt that by them putting themselves in the corner of being primarily truck and the SUV and the CUV manufacturers, I mean, it does limit somewhat their options. And, you know, in an economic downturn, trucks are very expensive. As you know, the average, you know, loan rate now is now trending up in the 70 months range or more, whatever. I do think people are stretching themselves awfully hard to buy these trucks because it's a huge, huge fad at the moment. I mean, I just see it here all the time. In my neighborhood, this is a very progressive town, and I see people showing up with big trucks in the driveway here in my part of town, which didn't, they used to drive small Toyotas and whatever. It's amazing. I'm blown away by it.
In South Eugene, this is a very unusual trend. Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's a question for you guys. All right. So Ford, they were losing money on these small cars. And now they cut their OPEX by whatever X. I don't know. I forget what the exact number is. Suppose there is a spike in oil prices. Couldn't they just start shipping in vehicles from overseas factories?
If we had global standards, it would be incredibly easy, and it's incredibly stupid that we don't have global standards. So, you know, it's easier now, I think, to design cars to do both, and maybe that's something you're going to hedge on in the future, but they'd have to plan for that because, I mean, look at the Ranger. They've been talking about bringing the Ranger in for years, but it wasn't designed to be sold in the U.S., and it's taken them years to get a new version up and going, and they've missed out on a big chunk of the medium-sized compact truck market because of that.
Do you guys think that this represents a bet that battery electric vehicles or hybrids are going to show up before oil prices spike?
Well, you know, that's a good question. My concern is that I don't know how well is going to do with Ford with electric vehicles. I mean, they've so far, all they've had is a compliance car, the Focus, which has done nothing. And they don't have any kind of established brand around that. So that part of it is what kind of worries me. They claim, of course, everyone has, you know, gobs of electric vehicles in the pipeline and hybrids. But whether they will sell at the retail level, I mean, there's still some huge questions about the size of the EV market and whether companies like Ford that have had done almost nothing in it, are people going to go to a Ford dealer to look for an electric car? I don't know.
That's the other thing people forget is that the amount of money it takes to invest into small cars to keep them on the cutting edge of efficiency, whatever, it takes a lot of money. These are big investments. And then the return is not very big on the other side. Electric cars, to some extent, are almost like more extreme version of that, where you really have to make, especially when you're transitioning towards them, big investments in the batteries and the technology and the production, all of that totally different production systems. And then what's the return? I think there's so much uncertainty around the electric market. This move seems like a fundamentally kind of defensive play by Ford. I think going too big into electric cars would kind of mitigate that. I don't know.
I agree.
If this makes any sense at all, it's predicated on the belief that people aren't going to really want small cars in the future, and or ceding that market to other manufacturers to lose their shirts makes sense. So if that's true, who's the next manufacturer who's going to stop it? I guess a domestic manufacturer who's going to cut their small car line?
Well, GM, they've already, the Sonic has basically been given, right? That's been given a sentence.
They cut production on it.
Yeah. And the Impala has basically been given, an informal death sentence. And the Cruise, they just cut back to one shift, which means that plant is not operating profitably. They're losing money undoubtedly on it. And so that's vulnerable.
You know, it's interesting that I mentioned this earlier, but you talked about the Cadet having, can't cancel because it couldn't hit its 30% margin. When the GM ignition switch crisis happened, Congress subpoenaed a bunch of documents. And one of the things about the development of the Cobalt, and one of the things that really jumped out at me about that was that it was actually designed with, I think, either a zero, as a program, it was developed with the assumption that there would be a 0% or maybe even like -1% or -2% margin on it. So that just kind of shows you how much things changed from the 60s until sort of the late 90s, early 2000s.
Oh, all through the 90s and the aughts and until recently even, it's been a little better in some years, although now it's slipping back to that. But all through the 90s and the aughts, GM and Ford lost huge amounts of money on all their smaller and mid-sized cars. When these cars first came out, like the GM, the Cavalier, that J car, that was going to be the car that was intended to go right up against the Accord. Well, I mean, that was like, no way. When it arrived, the Accord was already miles and miles ahead of it. And they priced it way too high, and they had to back off on the pricing. And ever since 1982, 83, when they came out with that and had a poor entry in the market, the Cavalier just became a cheap car to simply offset the higher fuel consumption of their Cadillacs and trucks and other cars, whatever. And they lost money on those for decades. That was the old way. But the new CAFE rules are somewhat more beneficial to them in that regard, and they don't really have to build small cars. And that's another reason why they're getting out.
So we're almost out of time here, but I have one more question that I want to ask you about, because I think it's an interesting aspect of this. I'm curious about your thoughts. So it seems to me that, you're mentioning a 2008 scenario is not as likely because trucks, SUVs, crossovers have all become so much more efficient. Essentially, the gap between cars and SUVs and crossovers in terms of the fuel costs has gone down. There's so much focus on all these new mobility technologies, but in some ways, is this situation different because without as much fanfare and as much coverage in the media, gas technology has just improved so steadily, relentlessly over, the past several decades. Then the real question is that going to continue? I mean, has gas technology sort of topped out here, or are we going to continue to see this progress? Because I think there's a lot of perception that gas is tapped out and that it has to go to electric in order to continue to improve emissions, fleet emissions. I'm curious about how you see that all playing out.
There will continue to be improvements. I mean, everyone is still working on that. And I've read some interesting articles in it lately about that. Toyota, their latest gas four-cylinder series can achieve optimum efficiency rates of 42%, which is phenomenal. Used to be diesel territory. There will continue to be improvements, but they're going to be expensive too. And that's the problem, is the economics of it. I mean, the latest Nissan's variable compression engine, very interesting and very efficient, but very expensive to build, about $2,000. And Nissan's latest super high compression, also expensive, but a lot of potential. I mean, the cost will come on eventually. Toyota is taking a more conservative approach and not going with massive downsizing and with turbos or whatever, because they have their hybrid technology, which now is going to become increasingly price competitive with these more expensive gasoline technologies. So there will continue to be improvements. And I think the 40 mile per gallon regular realistic, consumption of a medium ish size car and sedan, is at hand. I mean, I think it's already affecting Prius sales. Prius sales are down substantially last couple of years, of course, for a number of reasons. But one of them is because cheaper regular sedans are increasingly getting better mileage, and the difference is not that great.
All right. Well, we unfortunately have to wrap it up. I could keep talking about this topic forever, as I'm sure could you. But thank you. Dad, thank you so much for finally coming on the show. It's always fun to chat about this stuff. Where can folks follow your work, find out more about you, that kind of a thing?
CurbsideClassic.com.
All right. Dad is not on social media.
No. Old fashioned.
Yeah. Alex, what are you up to? What do you got coming up? Where can people find you?
I have a secret project I can't reveal for a few days, but it's going to upset a lot of people, and it pertains to the language of automation and autonomy. And I can be found at AlexRoy144 on all platforms.
All right. And I'm on Twitter at Tweetermeyer. I have a piece on today's topic actually coming up. It'll probably be up on Bloomberg View by the time this goes live. So check that out. I've got some other stuff coming up that you'll be hearing about soon. But thank you all for listening to another episode of the Autonocast, and we hope to see you back here next time.
I'm honored. Thank you for having me. Yep.